This meeting is now being recorded. All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing star 6.
Hello, if you're just dialing into the call, we'll be getting started in just a few minutes. Please stand by. Hi, if you're just dialing into the call, we'll be getting started in just a few minutes. Please stand by. Hi, if you're just dialing into the call, we'll be getting started in just a few minutes. Please stand by. Hi, if you've just dialed in, we're going to give people just a couple more minutes to dial in, so please go ahead and remain on mute until the Q&A period, and stand by. Thanks. Hi, thanks for dialing in. We're going to get started in just a few minutes. We're giving people another minute or so to dial into the line. Thank you. Hi, if you're just dialing in, I just want to let you know we're going to start in just another minute or so. We're letting other people dial in. Thanks. Hello, thank you for dialing into the call this afternoon. As you noted when you dialed in, your line is on mute, and we ask that people remain muted until the Q&A section of the call. The way to mute and unmute your lines is to hit the star and six. I'm going to go ahead and pass it over to Melissa Crow, the director of the Legal Action Center. Melissa?
Thank you, Wendy. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our briefing on access to counsel restrictions before the immigration agencies. We have a panel of very distinguished legal experts who will share their perspectives, which are based on firsthand experience representing clients in a variety of contexts before the Department of Homeland Security. I'm pleased to announce that the American Immigration Counsel's Legal Action Center is releasing a report entitled Behind Closed Doors, an overview of DHS restrictions on access to counsel, which is now available on our website at www.legalactioncenter.org under What's New, right on our homepage. We'll post a recording of today's presentation, which means that we are recording this call. Access to counsel lies at the very core of our legal system, and it's integral to ensuring a fair process and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. The Legal Action Center has long advocated for the right to counsel for all non-citizens, both in immigration court and in administrative proceedings before DHS, which are the focus of our discussion today. Under the immigration laws, non-citizens who are subject to removal proceedings in immigration court may be represented by lawyers secured at their own expense. Unfortunately, non-citizens whose immigration status is determined outside the courtroom, for example, in benefits interviews before the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, interrogations by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, and certain types of inspections by Customs and Border Protection, are often denied the right to legal representation. Reports from immigration lawyers across the country, which were jointly collected by the American Immigration Council, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and Penn State Law's Center for Immigrants' Rights, indicate that all three DHS immigration agencies often interfere with attorneys' efforts to represent their clients in these types of administrative settings. Specifically, our findings reveal, first, that CBP routinely bars access to counsel, relying on outdated regulations and overly restrictive interpretations of guidance to justify its limitations. CBP officers also discourage non-citizens from seeking counsel. Second, ICE fails to provide or facilitate access to counsel when questioning represented individuals, often restricts attorney-client communications in detention facilities, and like CBP, discourages non-citizens from seeking legal counsel. Finally, while USCIS officers have failed to allow appropriate access to counsel in the past, recent changes to the adjudicator's field manual appear to be expanding non-citizens' right to legal representation to some extent. The Immigration Council's report analyzes the legal framework that governs access to counsel in DHS proceedings and concludes that the restrictions imposed by DHS officials are, in many cases, at odds with existing law and agency guidance. We've sought to bring our concerns to the attention of each of the immigration agencies, but only USCIS has been at all responsive. As part of our administrative advocacy efforts, the Immigration Council also submitted detailed Freedom of Information Act requests to USCIS, ICE, and CBP in an effort to obtain comprehensive guidance on access to counsel. Ultimately, we were forced to sue all three agencies based on their inadequate responses to our requests. We filed suit against USCIS and CBP in November of 2011, and we filed suit against ICE just this morning. All three of those lawsuits remain pending. After our speakers have presented their remarks, there will be an opportunity for question and answer. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the floor over to our first speaker, David Leopold, who's the immediate past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and is in private immigration practice in Cleveland, Ohio. David's going to address the implications of DHS's restrictions on access to counsel for an immigration system that is already quite broken. David?
Thank you, Melissa. Good afternoon to everybody. I think the bottom line to going through the report is that what we need here are comprehensive standards regarding right to counsel and protection of right to counsel that are consistent throughout the Department of Homeland Security. It shouldn't be dependent. A person's right to counsel shouldn't be dependent on which agent or which agency they are before. And as it stands right now, people's right to counsel varies differently among not only the agencies, being CBP, ICE, and USCIS, but in fact varies among which agent a person might encounter within a specific jurisdiction. And that's just not appropriate. Many of the decisions that are made by the immigration enforcement decisions that are made by the agency are not made in immigration court. Immigration court makes a percentage of the decisions about people's fate. Many of the decisions are made by the agency, by the bureaucrats within the agency. And when that's coupled with restrictions on right to counsel, people's rights are violated day in and day out. Let me focus for a moment on ICE. My colleague Bob Paugh is going to talk about CBP, and then later we'll hear about CIS. With respect to ICE, which is in charge of enforcing the immigration law as opposed to giving out benefits, ICE is in charge of investigating immigration violations. The right to counsel is tenuous at best. Frequently what happens is individuals who are taken into custody go through processing within an ICE field office. Whether or not they do have counsel at that point is typically not even an issue. They're subject to questioning, sometimes subject to written statements. And most importantly, they're not either given the right to have an attorney with them during questioning or post-arrest interrogation and interviews, but they're affirmatively, in many cases, discouraged from having an attorney present. And that can happen in a number of ways. It can happen, first of all, by somebody who is an individual is arrested, for example, and told by the ICE agent, you know what, you have a choice. You can stay under arrest and you can stay in detention. If you want to call an attorney, I suppose you can. But if you do that, you're going to spend 2 months in jail waiting for an immigration judge, maybe longer. You're better off signing here and going back to your country. And guess what? If you do that, you can always apply for admission to come back in. That's a frequent story that I hear from people, meaning spouses whose loved ones have been deported, that they were told that they could apply for readmission, that they were not advised that they had the right to talk to an attorney before they sign documents, that they were not advised that they had the right to an attorney during questioning. And as an attorney, not only personally, but through discussions with colleagues, it's a frequent occurrence that that ICE will not permit counsel to speak with an arrested individual immediately after arrest while they're in processing. What happens is ICE will say, if counsel calls over to ICE, an individual is arrested, counsel is contacted by family or by the individual. The individual, the attorney calls ICE, and ICE, the first question that ICE asks is, the agent asks is, do you have a G28 on file? For some of you that don't know what that is, the regulations require that attorneys in immigration context file a formal notice of appearance, and the form that is used is called a G28. So that's what I'm referring to. Typically, immigration will not speak to counsel without a G28 having been filed. Now, in an emergency situation where somebody's been arrested and may be facing imminent deportation, perhaps there's a final order on that person, a final order of deportation outstanding on that person, or some other reason, the fact that a piece of paper has not been filed or cannot physically be filed instantaneously should not give ICE license to keep an attorney from his or her client. And that's what happens all the time. Now, there are situations where the right ICE agent or a decent ICE agent will say, hey, no problem, you can talk to your client. And that's all well and good, but that is dependent on who picks up the phone at the other end, and that's not how the rule of law should be working. ICE agents should be taught and trained to affirmatively present the right to counsel to arrested individuals, and at least at a minimum, provide them with the advice that they do have the right to counsel, albeit not paid for by the government, but the right to independent counsel. And what we have now is actually quite the opposite. Also, I should affirmatively accept counsel's documents and counsel's forms and representation for a client, and they don't always do it. Sometimes it's discouraged. I can give an example of an incident that occurred yesterday. A client went to the immigration, to ICE, to file a stay of deportation. The law does require when a stay of deportation is filed that it be filed personally by the applicant. And in this jurisdiction, that is enforced to the letter. The applicant showed up at 3 o'clock, and the ICE agent wouldn't take the documents because they are only open till 3 o'clock. That is an affirmative denial of not only the right to redress, but the right to counsel, because that was prepared and there was a G28. So what I'm saying is that there's not only is the culture not embracing of the right to counsel, but it affirmatively goes the other way. Counsel are routinely viewed as the problem, not part of the solution. And it's a world of difference when you walk into a criminal court, federal district court, in a criminal case where not only is the right to counsel tolerated, nothing can happen without counsel present. Questioning, nothing, as long as the person indicates they have that right, they have counsel. At a minimum, some of the recommendations ought to be implemented, and this would the report. And I will conclude and let my colleagues go on. And these would include, you know, like I said, affirmative advice on the right to counsel by ICE agents before, during, and after arrest and questioning, acceptance of counsel's representations and paper, you know, documents and arguments, for anybody, whether they're in custody or not. That if they're going to speak to somebody, if ICE agent is going to speak to somebody who claims to have counsel, that before they do so, if the person has a lawyer, that they are required to get a written waiver from that person that they're giving up the right to counsel. That's not done at this point. So there's actually no written record of how this happens, how a person's statement is taken without counsel after the, for example, a person goes in, the person is arrested, and the person says, well, I have a lawyer, I'd like to speak to my lawyer. And ICE agent either ignores it or says, well, your lawyer doesn't have a G28, no representation form on file, I need to ask you some questions. If that's the situation, they should not be allowed to ask those questions without at least an express written waiver. That's a violation of the person's right to counsel. In a sense, let me summarize this by saying what we need, at least in ICE, and I believe in the other agencies, other bureaus of the agency, is a change in culture. Lawyers are officers of the court. Lawyers are ethically bound to their state bars. They can be disciplined if they act unethically. So there is redress for the lawyer who might pull the trick on ICE. But as it stands now, it's the exception that lawyers are treated with fundamental respect and as part of the system, as a part of the solution to immigration enforcement, and that needs to change.
David, thank you. I'm going to turn the floor now over to Robert Powell, who's a partner with Gibbs, Houston & Powell in Seattle, Washington. And Bob is going to elaborate further on the day-to-day impact of the restrictions for non-citizens and the lawyers who represent them, with a particular focus on practices of Customs and Border Protection.
Thank you, Melissa. Let me begin with the Administrative Procedures Act, which is a law passed by Congress that applies generally to administrative agencies, all administrative agencies, including CBP, Customs and Border Protection, USCIS, and ICE. And one of the provisions in the statute is gives a right to representation. If a person is compelled to appear before an agency, then that person has the right to be represented and advised by counsel. As that applies to CBP, for example, a person drives up to, let's say, a person from Canada, which is where at least some of my clientele is. A person from Canada drives up to the border and asks for admission into the United States and is referred to secondary inspection. At that point, there's no right to say, well, you know what, I changed my mind, I think I'll go back home. The person is required to appear before the inspecting immigration officer. And under the Administrative Procedures Act, therefore, would have a right to counsel. Or for another example, sometimes people are seeking entry into the United States are referred to what's called a deferred inspection, which basically means the person has to report to a CBP office in the interior somewhere, not exactly at the border, but typically inside. So, for example, here a deferred inspection may occur in Seattle, many miles away from the border. At that point, the person is required to appear, compelled to appear. If the person does not appear, the person is subject to being arrested and put in deportation proceedings. So under the Administrative Procedures Act, there's a very clear right to be represented by an attorney. In many other agencies outside of the immigration context, of course, that right is certainly respected and there's not any issue or not any problem representing the person before the agency. One of the biggest problems that we have with respect to the right to counsel is CBP's policy of not allowing counsel to appear in these secondary inspections or deferred inspections. When a person appears at the border with counsel, and this has happened to me several times, I appear there with a client to explain the right to admission. The CBP officer typically says, well, you know, there's no right for the person to have a lawyer here. I've been told to sit on the other side of the room while CBP officers interrogate my client. Sometimes they'll take the client inside to an interrogation room and not allow me to be present with the client. Lack of an attorney being present can be a major problem, especially where there are legal issues involved in the case. I think generally we do not have a problem with CBP's position that with respect to the facts underlying the case, they want to hear that from the client. They don't want the lawyer to explain the facts of the case. And I think that's people understand that and are fine with that. But the problem is where there are difficult or complicated legal issues involved, it's certainly appropriate for an attorney to provide an explanation, to provide case law, regulations, or legal documents. So, for example, when we have a professional coming into the United States on a non-immigrant visa, quite often there may be legal questions. For example, a person coming in as an executive, there's a technical legal definition of what constitutes a, quote, executive, and there may be legal explanations that should be provided as to why the person coming in constitutes a, quote, executive. Or, for example, where a person has a criminal record. A person may have a criminal record but not be excludable from the United States. So there may be a legal question about what constitutes a, quote, crime of moral turpitude, a legal concept that may be relevant, which can be very difficult and complicated, and it may be appropriate for legal argumentation on that issue. And in a whole range of cases, there may be legal questions that come up where an attorney's advice and representation is appropriate and facilitates resolution of the question. The problem is border officers making these decisions are not attorneys. They may have some training in immigration law, but they certainly are not aware of the legal niceties. They certainly do not know how to do legal research, and they quite often they make decisions that are legally incorrect. There have been any number of occasions when I've seen border officers give information that is legally just flat out wrong. So an attorney in this context is really essential in many of these cases to get a correct resolution of the case. CBP's policy of not allowing lawyers dates back to before 1996, when there was a significant change in the law. The rationale before 1996 was that border officers were not authorized to make the ultimate decision in the case. If they had questions and were not sure what the correct answer was, then the case was to be referred to an immigration judge, and in the context of an immigration court proceeding, the person, of course, does have the right to an attorney, to the assistance of an attorney. And so the ultimate resolution, by the time when there's an ultimate resolution in the case, an attorney was involved or could be involved. The person had the right to counsel. In 1996, there were significant changes in the law, one of which allows Border Patrol officers to make a final decision right at the border and issue an order of deportation. That policy changed, but the CBP policy of not allowing counsel did not change at that time, and so their position now is that these final decisions can be made, orders of deportation can be issued against persons without the assistance of counsel. That's been a major problem, one of the major problems that we see, at least in the context of representation before CBP. So with that, let me turn it back over to Melissa.
Thanks, Bob. Our next speaker is Karen Griset, who is the chair of the American Bar Association's Commission on Immigration and public service counsel at the law firm of Freed Frank here in Washington, D.C. And Karen's going to address relevant ABA policies on these issues.
Thank you very much, Melissa, and thanks for including the ABA in the discussion today. First, I want to compliment the American Immigration Council and Penn State on this excellent report, and clarify right at the beginning that when we discuss ABA policy, we're speaking about policy formally adopted by the ABA's House of Delegates, which is the legislative body of the ABA. Many people on the call may know that access to counsel is a major policy concern of the ABA generally across the board, not limited to the immigration context. But going beyond that, ABA has a very specific policy about access to counsel in the immigration area. The first one, very broadly, would basically cover everything we're talking about today if we said nothing else. That is, the ABA has policy favoring access to counsel in all immigration-related proceedings. That includes removal proceedings, administrative interviews, consular interviews, any contact with government agencies in the immigration-related context. But for today, we are focusing only on persons appearing before DHS administratively in one of the three underlying agencies and not those in removal proceedings. So again, the main one is that the ABA supports availability of legal representation to all non-citizens in immigration-related matters, and that clearly includes expedited removal that we were just discussing, inspections, and administrative interviews. The ABA has more specific policy that urges effective access to counsel for all detainees, including for interviews and any processing appointments. Another specific policy supports access to legal assistance for persons arrested or detained in connection with immigration enforcement actions, including large-scale worksite enforcement actions. And the policy is that those enforcement actions and subsequent proceedings, whether criminal or immigration or both, should be carried out in a manner that ensures, and there are several different points here, number one, that individuals are provided notice of the right to consult with attorney and afforded access to competent legal counsel. Second, that individuals receive a legal orientation and complete an accurate translation of the investigation and proceedings in a way that enables them to understand their rights. Third, that individuals have adequate access to telephones in order to consult with counsel, and that indigent individuals are permitted to make an adequate number of telephone calls to counsel free of charge. And fourth, in this area, that attorneys are afforded an adequate opportunity to consult in private with each client and to investigate and fully evaluate the facts and circumstances pertaining to the client's case. Beyond that, in the detention context, the ABA has policy opposing involuntary transfer of detainees to locations that would interfere with access to counsel where there is an existing attorney-client relationship. And finally, opposes detention at remote locations, even in the absence of an attorney-client relationship that would prohibit access to counsel. Many of these policies are based on the need to protect the due process rights of the individuals, but also a concern for the efficiency of the immigration court system. The ABA has a great desire to keep cases out of immigration court that shouldn't be there, and many of the examples provided earlier on the call by Dave and Bob, and even in more detail, other examples that are in the report, well illustrate how access to counsel and the presence of attorneys in inspections or in interviews could minimize the placement of people in removal proceedings and in immigration court where they need there to seek termination or relief that could have been resolved in the course of the original inspection or interview if the attorney had been able to participate. And then there are two other policies I should mention that go beyond mere access to counsel, but in the case of two specific populations, the ABA has policy that there should not only be access, but appointed counsel, legal representation in any immigration-related proceedings, and that is for mentally ill and disabled persons, and similarly to unaccompanied children at all stages and in any aspect of immigration processes or proceedings. So I think that's all, Melissa, that the 5 minutes will allow.
Thank you. And finally, my colleague Emily Creighton, who is a staff attorney with the American Immigration Council's Legal Action Center and one of the primary authors of the report, will discuss our recommendations to combat DHS's harmful practices and ultimately to improve access to counsel in administrative proceedings. Emily?
Thank you, Melissa. I wanted to begin by pointing you to the recommendations, which are actually on page 23 of the report. And I will mention in a couple places where there have been some improvements in guidance on access to counsel with USCIS and that those improvements were amendments that were made by the agency to their adjudicator's field manual, which is a manual used by USCIS officers for our purposes, the sections where they provide guidance for officers that are USCIS officers that are conducting interviews with individuals. So I want to begin by just sort of highlighting what David mentioned earlier, is that through our survey in 2010, where we reached out to immigration attorneys and heard back from them about problems that they were having accessing their clients and their clients were having accessing them in proceedings before USCIS, CBP, and ICE, really one of the fundamental problems, one of the underlying problems, was that there was not uniform guidance, that DHS did not have guidance and uniformly apply the regulations to improve access to counsel and to provide meaningful access to counsel. So immigrants, immigrant clients and their attorneys were left sort of, it was a guessing game as to the scope and extent of the restrictions on counsel in different DHS proceedings. Now, we recognize that the nature of interactions with ICE, CBP, and USCIS may vary, but believe strongly that DHS can develop a broad-based policy that emphasizes the importance of meaningful access to counsel. And it's equally as critical that DHS explicitly recognize that non-citizens have a right to counsel and have a right to have meaningful access to that counsel in proceedings before DHS. To the extent to which an attorney may advocate for his or her client, we want it to be clear what is the role of counsel. We want DHS to define that much more clearly. And it should be clear that an attorney is able to object to inappropriate lines of questioning, to ask clarifying questions, to facilitate communication in general between the client and the DHS officer involved, and importantly, to advise their clients in these interactions with DHS on points of law. And that can be both orally and in writing and in submissions that they actually hand over to the officer, to the DHS officer. And this is just vital to having a uniform understanding of the importance of counsel among the three agencies. Another point that David made, which I just want to reiterate, is this code of conduct. We recommend that DHS adopt the code of conduct. The culture is part of the problem, as David mentioned, and we want to encourage an atmosphere of mutual respect between government officials and their attorneys. Just in the implementation piece of this, DHS, it's important that DHS take the steps to implement the recommendations through a commitment to training, feedback, and follow-through, and that its employees, again, understand the role of counsel and work with counsel to ensure efficient proceedings. I'm going to jump into USCIS and some of our recommendations there, but I want to say that in the last year or so, we really have had a lot of meaningful conversations with that agency and have new guidance that they've distributed, as I mentioned, to their field officers that explain how USCIS officers should interact with counsel. And so our recommendations, unfortunately, did not change, though this new guidance was issued on May 23rd, because the essence of the recommendations really haven't been addressed, but I will mention in a couple places where USCIS has improved its guidance. First, though this may seem like a small problem, attorneys have emphasized how important it is that they are actually physically seated next to their clients during USCIS interviews. And USCIS has stated in its new guidance in response to advocacy by our organization and others that a representative should be permitted to sit next to the client during the interview, but unfortunately there is some discretion there, and they go on to say in the guidance, unless this cannot be accommodated due to the physical layout of the interview space. And so we recommend if sufficient seating isn't available, the officer should offer to reschedule the interview, and in general, field offices should be altered to allow for more space for interviews if they don't currently have the space available. An important issue is statements are submitted by attorneys, both written and oral statements. We recommend that they be included in the record, and that all case-related documentation submitted by counsel be included in the record. That has not always been the case, and continues to be a problem. as David mentioned, it's critical that unrepresented individuals be advised of their right to counsel at no expense to the government, and that USCIS provide a list of free legal service providers to these unrepresented individuals. If the individual is represented, USCIS should require a written waiver of representation before questioning that person. Now, they do currently and have added this to their new guidance. They have a new requirement that there be a written waiver, but we want there to also be questions that the USCIS officer is required to ask the individual to ensure that they understand that they have a right to their counsel, their counsel's presence during that interview. Also, there's no signature required, so we would like for the statement to actually be signed by the interviewee. Finally, USCIS should stop terminating interviews. This is a problem that we heard about not infrequently. Not that USCIS would terminate interviews if the attorney advocated on behalf of their client, but that they would threaten to terminate interviews. And we think that it should be very clear what an attorney is allowed to do and what the attorney is not allowed to do during USCIS interviews. And we think an attorney should be allowed, and this should be stated clearly, that the attorney should be able to facilitate communication during the interview, object to inappropriate questioning, and provide legal analysis to the individual being interviewed or to the USCIS officer interviewing their client. Customs and Border Protection and ICE, some of the recommendations are similar. Here, we've made very little progress with these agencies in terms of even beginning discussions about understanding current policies and procedures. As Melissa mentioned, we've had to file FOIA requests and even go to court to try to find out what their policies are. But similarly, CBP and ICE should, in the case of CBP, I'll just begin by saying and reiterating what Bob said before, that since changes in the law in 2006, they should amend the regulation that currently prohibits or states that there is no right to representation in primary and secondary inspection. That is no longer an appropriate restriction given the introduction of expedited removal with the passage of new laws in 2006. In addition, when counsel isn't present, CBP, like USCIS, should require a written waiver of representation before questioning an individual outside the presence of counsel. That waiver should be signed by the individual and placed in the record, and the individual should understand the implications of waiving their right to counsel, and that would be achieved through CBP officers asking specific questions before requesting that the individual sign the statement. And another problem that comes up frequently is rescheduling interviews. CBP and ICE should develop a clear process for rescheduling inspection interviews in the case of CBP and ICE interviews. I think I'll just be repetitive if I go into the recommendations for ICE. They are similar to CBP with the advisals and the waiver requirements. But I do want to just emphasize that in the case of ICE, there should be in the detention setting more meaningful steps to improve attorneys' access to their detained clients, including developing more flexible visitation policies, providing meeting rooms when appropriate and when necessary, and limiting the periods during which detainees are not available to meet with counsel. And a point that David picked up on before and is critically important is that the G28 form, ICE should be much more active in helping attorneys obtain signed G28 forms from their detained clients, which is sort of a starting point for meaningful access to counsel in detention settings.
So, Emily, thank you.
With that, I will turn it over back to Melissa.
Thanks. At this point, we'd like to open up the lines for Q&A. If you'd like to ask a question, please hit *6 on your phone. We'd be grateful if you could identify yourself and your affiliation before posing your question. And once you've asked your question, remember to hit *6 once again. If your question is directed to a particular person, please let us know that. Thank you.
Again, hit *6 to ask any questions. Any questions on the line? *6 will unmute your line.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question, if I might. Have any of these issues...
Can you give us your name and affiliation, please?
This is Peter Allen. I'm an immigration lawyer here in Boston, and I've been practicing it for a while, about 30 years, I guess. My question is, have these recommendations been brought to the attention of any member of the relevant congressional committees?
Not at this juncture. We just issued the report today, so that will certainly be part of our agenda going forward.
Hi, this is Maria, an immigration attorney in the East Bay, California. I'd like to ask a question. Where can we access the report?
The report is on the Legal Action Center's website. If you go to our homepage at www.legalactioncenter.org, you will see a section called What's New, and it's front and center. And then you can also go on the Access to Counsel page of our website for more discussion and analysis of these issues and other work that we've done on them.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Go ahead and speak up if you have a question. Just hit the star and six to unmute your line, and then go ahead and ask your question. Okay, Melissa, it doesn't seem that we have any other questions.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their participation. And is there a question?
Yes. This is Ed Katzwolf, the Cynthia Grooms, D.C., an immigration firm, and it says the Maryland. Earlier when you were speaking of the ABA, the access to counsel to reasonable expectation, you know, private meeting with counsel, the Patriot Act seems to undermine some of those things. Is there an update to that?
From the ABA?
Yes.
Karen?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question very clearly. Somebody was typing.
Okay.
Would you mind repeating the question?
Absolutely. The Patriot Act seems to undermine the right to meet to a privacy expectation and meet with counsel. Is there an update to that or an amendment or something?
An amendment to the Patriot Act or an amendment to the ABA policy?
To that part of the policy, but that part as far as the Patriot Act, because we've been led to believe that there's, in fact, that you can't count on the conversation being unmonitored.
Well, wait a minute. This is David. That would fall under some specific provisions, which I don't think are relevant to the day-to-day enforcement of immigration law.
Right. I think that's right.
I'm not sure that that's relevant to the day-to-day enforcement. So if they're telling you, if an ICE officer is telling you that he can't be there because of the Patriot Act, then I think you need to take action because that's just not appropriate. I'd go directly to the field office on that.
Right. The ABA policy is what it is, and to the extent it's contravened by the Patriot Act, the policy would nevertheless be for access to counsel, but it doesn't address Patriot Act considerations specifically.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Ivan B. Pfeiffer from Insight News, a newspaper publication in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm curious about the aspect of interrogation as to the effectiveness of it and why when the immigrants have their when they go through interrogation, why they're not allowed to have the representation present with them.
David, do you want to take that one?
Sure. It's not that they're not allowed. It's that ICE officers typically take a very restrictive view. And so there's two things that have to happen. A, the immigrant needs to know his or her rights, which isn't always the case, so they need to be advised. Therefore, they should be given advice as to the right to counsel not paid for by the government. And two, the officers themselves, need to have a culture where they are accepting of the right to counsel as part and parcel of the process. So, you know, if somebody is arrested and indicates that they have an attorney, then what this report is saying, and I think what we're all saying, is that the officers ought to go out of their way to make it possible and to give access. That would be facilitating the filing and the acceptance of a G-28. And I would even argue in an emergency situation, since they're talking to, if an attorney is on the phone or trying to get through and doesn't have a G-28, that they would waive the immediate G-28 requirement and under the proviso that the attorney would provide an appropriate G-28 at some point. In other words, that the representation by counsel that they are counsel of record and will be providing a G-28 should be enough. Counsel is a member of the bar and an officer of the court, and if an attorney takes advantage of that, they can certainly be disciplined. So ICE would have recourse. What I'm saying, and I think what everybody's saying, is that the culture needs to open up, and it needs to be a culture that embraces counsel. Appropriate counsel can facilitate and make the system make the enforcement of law actually run smoother than putting up bars and impediments all along the way and keeping counsel out of the picture. Just doesn't help anybody.
David, I just wanted to add that there's a very problematic decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals, which says that ICE is not even required to provide advisals regarding the right to counsel until a charging document has been filed with the immigration court. We are working on challenging that decision in a variety of jurisdictions, but the government chose the party line on that one. And they're
flat out wrong because if ICE, I don't care what the board says, if ICE arrests somebody and they're under the focus of the criminal investigation, the board has nothing to say about counsel there. And hopefully those challenges will prevail because that's just wrong-headed thinking.
And also, I just to direct you to the report, in footnote 30, we discussed the case that Melissa just referenced. And I think it's important to note that the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the administrative body that reviews immigration decisions from immigration courts, says that there is no right to an advisal or a warning that there is a right to counsel, but that doesn't mean that the right to counsel does not exist. So I think that's an important distinction.
And we've heard of a number of cases where individuals have actually requested the opportunity to speak to their lawyer at different stages of the process, and ICE has refused those as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
Other questions? In that case,
I have a comment.
Okay.
Sorry.
Who are you?
Hi, it's Cynthia Grooms, Cass, from I'm an immigration attorney in the Washington, D.C. area, and I just wanted to commend you all. I haven't had the opportunity to read the report yet, but this has been a fantastic conference call, and I'm looking forward to reading the report, and thank you all for all of your efforts.
Thank you,
Cynthia.
Find
a level playing field.
Thank you, and thanks to all the speakers and to the participants for joining today's call. Don't hesitate to contact us if you have other questions regarding the report. Wendy?
Hello?
Okay. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa. Bye.
Yes, thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
return. man out to fix the air conditioner.
Yeah.
It's still, he left. Mom said the temperature's going up in the house now.
Did he say it was done?
Yeah.
Well,
so
you got a
contract? I did. I got a supervisor.
Uh-huh.
We're sorry. Well, we're not going to be able to send anybody today. I'm like, okay, you have reached my limit on how long. I said, I am sticking to my sheets now. Mm-hmm. Every night. I said, it's 85 degrees. Well, it's going to be cooler today.
Thanks for that.
That's when he did that. That's when I started right into him. I said, it doesn't matter. I said, if it doesn't get fixed tomorrow and I got to go through a weekend, I'm going over your head tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. How about I'll be going to a motel for two of us and sending you the bill?
Well, that's the next step.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to send him the bill for the Saturday night one. And I said, I'm not spending a weekend without air conditioning. You're going to have to pay for a hotel. That's the next step. But they're going to have somebody between 8 and 12, and it's supposed to be tomorrow.
Not the same somebody.
No, it's going to be a senior technician. And if I have to hear the words, oh, we needed to order another part, and it won't be available until Monday or Tuesday, if you hear an explosion.
Oh, from down there?
Down
that
there,
could be what it is?
Yeah. Karen, I've reached my limit. I've had enough.
I understand.
A week.
That's going on a long time. Too long.
Well, when Ma said
I understand when it's a major storm, let's say. Winds are down all over. You know, everybody's shit is blown up. You know they can't get to everybody in one day.
Right.
That's not this.
No, they were out there last Thursday, mm-hmm. out there, determined it was a compressor, which is one of the major components.
Yeah, all right. I know what the compressor
is. Yeah, okay. So, of course, it's a Memorial Day weekend.
Of course.
And we had the wedding, and the whole shit. So we're over there. We're thankful we had that room for one night. Anyhow, so I call Monday. Oh, the parts department isn't open on Memorial Day weekend. I'm like, okay. So I'm getting Tuesday. I went through this loop. And I said, I have to call this number to get this person to call me at this number to get this to schedule.
Yeah, this guy better have you on the top of his list.
Oh, he told me 8 to 12. I said, I told him.
And your mom is right there anyway.
Right. I'm
huddled up in the basement.
No, actually, it is not cool in the basement. We don't have any fans there.
Yeah.
It is cooler, but because the air doesn't
move.
Yeah, but
by nature, it has to be cooler.
It is cooler, right, but the problem is because it's not circulating, it's also a little more humid.
Well, and your back in your family room goes at ground level, so
right.
That part's not underground.
Right.
Because of the grate.
Right. The coolest area is actually the laundry room.
So we could sit in there with a chair.
Yeah.
It'd be real comfortable.
And with a fan. With a fan down there. And that's the other problem. There's no air circulation going on as much. I mean, there's some blowing air, but it's hot air. It's 85 degree hot air.
Yeah,
I
don't want that.
No. So I told him, I said, it better be fixed tomorrow because I'm going over your head tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay. You got to play up the elderly card, too.
That's what I've been doing.
My mom
said
has
I have
a heart condition or some shit.
Of course she does.
She's getting one now.
Well,
no, that's you. Sorry.
That was Jack Palmer. All the fuck. Joe's heart. I'm like, no, that I had a stroke.
Joe's gonna have a stroke, right?
Joe had a stroke, but Joe didn't have a heart attack.
Right.
But now, Karen, I'm furious.
Say the wrath of Joe.
Okay. And I told
him. Did you tell him the toilet paper thing?
No, I didn't tell him about the toilet paper.
Well, you could tell him he's thinking he feels like he's toilet paper. Takes your money and throws you away.
You
could.
No.
It was fit.
No, and he could tell, no matter what he said at the end, he knew it wasn't satisfying. When he told me, oh, well, you're fortunate, it's going to be cooler tonight.
No, I'm not fortunate. Don't even try to sell me that.
So, where we got here? One more evening. That's it. And then over the head.
Did you see the certificate that Regina's got?
No, she showed me some of it.
Oh, take a look. She's got it mocked up real nice now.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, you went back to the
store? Yes. Plus, it looks better, plus it fits. It suits.
Just so you know, I went to David during said, are you planning to have this on the rooftop still, or are you going to have it inside? He goes, on the rooftop. I go, David, they're expecting severe thunderstorms tomorrow afternoon.
Well, they'll bring it in if that's the case.
Yeah. No, I said I didn't want him to, you know, he didn't realize thunderstorms were coming. So I wanted him to be aware that that's a possibility.
But the people know, too, right? I mean, the caterers know. The building people know that they can't set up outside.
Yeah.
If it's...
Yeah.
Plus, it doesn't even have to be a thunderstorm for it to be too windy up there.
Yeah.
I've been up there plenty of times, and it just sucks. Because the wind blows
that
it's rooftop. It's no fun. You can't hold on to a drink or anything.
No, you're holding this. And it's a good thing we don't have many people with toupees.
Yeah, really. Well, it ruins my hair anyway, and it doesn't have to be a toupee. I don't like to go where the wind is blowing.
Yeah. So I was going to say, if it's not over their heads, it's off with their heads.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Oh, Joe? Did they tell you anything about Tuesday for the ball?
I'll call her right now. I'll be right there.
Okay. I'm going